Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Justice Antonin Scalia, his impact goes much farther than the debate over his replacement. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, February 15th, 2016. Happy to be with you. Let's get right to the news. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia died of a reported heart attack this weekend. But even before his body made it back to his home in Virginia, Washington was already well into the debate over what his death means for the Supreme Court and for the political process. For more, I'm joined from Washington by Marketplace's Kimberly Adams. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, Molly.
Now, Kimberly, obviously the Supreme Court deals with all sorts of issues, but when it comes to business and the economy specifically, what kind of legacy does Justice Scalia leave behind?
So even though Justice Scalia is known as a social conservative and being very strong on these social issues, he was also a fiscal conservative. He actually had some economic training in addition to legal training, and that came out in a lot of his decisions. I was speaking with Gregory McGarian, a law professor at Washington University, and he said that was especially clear in the way that Scalia influenced the Citizens United case. And we'll remember that because that's the one that said corporations could contribute to political campaigns.
Justice Scalia actually made an affirmative case that corporations were important and should be heard in the political process because of their economic power and significance. And that's a big idea that I don't think has gotten a lot of attention, but it's certainly something he contributed to that decision.
He was very much someone who said that because corporations and businesses are such drivers of the economy, they need to have a role in the political process. And that made him a darling of many businesses and corporations. And I was speaking with one Republican analyst today who told me it's going to be very, very hard to find somebody as fiscally conservative to replace him.
Interesting. And then this fight, of course, over who will replace him and when is not just gearing up, I would say, in full swing. Is the money machine also already at work?
Well, we definitely saw over the weekend that the presidential candidates were quick to jump on this as an issue to try and rally their various bases and say that, look, you know, we need a Democratic president because of the Supreme Court, or we need a Republican president because of the Supreme Court. And so we are likely to see a lot more fundraising off of that issue. But additionally, there's a lot of key Senate races. Remember, the Senate has to confirm nominees to the Supreme Court. And so a lot of senators, especially those from swing districts, are looking very nervous. And there's already organizations and companies and political campaigns lining up to try and say, look, we are going to funnel money into this issue because it's so key. And a lot of those Republican senators that are up for re-election are going to have a really hard time with their donors if they end up on the record as supporting an Obama nominee to the Supreme Court.
Right. So it's clear that this is probably going to take a while. So what about those cases that are already in the pipeline? What'll happen to those?
It's a bit unclear, and there are a lot of really key cases. We're looking at issues related to Obamacare and abortion and affirmative action and trade unions. The list goes on. And Scalia was likely to be a swing vote, a key vote on many of those decisions. So what do we have now? We've got many cases where the split is going to be 4-4. And so in those cases, a couple of things could happen. Either it could get kicked down and say, well, the lower court's decision stands and we're not going to do anything with it, or it could be that the court decides that they are going to re-argue those cases at a later date. But again, if this process stretches on too long, they're not going to want to keep doing that. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how that plays out.
That's Marketplace's Kimberly Adams in Washington. Thanks so much, Kimberly.
Thank you, Molly.
Markets here are closed for President's Day, but global markets rallied on rising oil prices and happy talk from the central bank. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. quiz, everyone. What do you think is the most downloaded music streaming app right now? It is not Apple Music. It is not Pandora. It is not even Spotify. It's Tidal. What was an also-ran service owned by Jay-Z is suddenly getting lots of attention. The reason comes down to two words, Kanye and Beyonce. But will it last? Nova Sappho explains.
On Saturday Night Live over the weekend, Kanye West debuted songs from his latest album.
We on our ultralight beam.
We on an ultralight beam. This is a God dream. This is a God dream. This is everything.
Then at the end of the song, West said this.
I'm going to show KanyeWest.com right now. Tidal streaming right now. Right now, mom.
Yeah. So if you didn't catch that, Wes said the album's available on his website and on Tidal. That mention and a tweet directing his fans to the music streaming service is all it took to catapult Tidal to become the number one free download on Apple.
Tidal's trying to position itself as having these exclusive deals.
Jeremy Morris teaches media and culture studies at the University of Wisconsin. He credits West for the Tidal bump and says an exclusive single from Beyonce a week earlier also brought lots of attention to the music streamer.
Increasingly, we're going to see these exclusive offers as these services jockey to say, you know, where do we stand in this market?
A market crowded with Spotify, Pandora, and deep-pocketed rivals such as Apple Music. And while exclusive artist deals are one way to stand out, they're also a hard way, says Casey Ray. He heads the Future of Music Coalition, a musicians' advocacy group.
We see a very, very small pool at this point of globally bankable superstars.
And few of those superstars are on independent labels, allowing them the freedom to make deals with Tidal. That's why Casey Ray suspects Tidal's bump will be temporary. Gigi Johnson, who heads the UCLA Center for Music Innovation, says the battle isn't even about getting attention.
It's great to be popping on the app list. How do you get those people to actually, and when the free trial is over, to stay?
Johnson says that's still a tough proposition because we're so accustomed to getting music for free. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Now, today, President's Day is a federal holiday, but it is a workday for many retail workers. President's Day sales are everywhere. And store owners are feeling a little desperate. Retail sales have been just okay recently. Christmas season was meh. January saw a little bit of a pickup, but there is a lot of inventory hanging around store shelves. Now, though, that most of us can comparison shop online 24/7, does a holiday sale even matter anymore? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman takes a look.
President's Day sales are a way for retailers to get Americans' blood pumping for shopping after the post-Christmas doldrums set in.
February is really just not such a great time for retail.
Patty Edwards tracks the retail industry at U.S. Bank Wealth Management in Seattle.
Kids spent their money that they got for Christmas. The parents are facing the credit card bills. You're kind of in between on the clothing seasons.
So President's Day typically focuses on big-ticket, cozy weather items like furniture and appliances, plus anything that didn't sell at Christmas on clearance sale. Consumer psychologist Kit Yarrow at Golden Gate University says with its depressing weather and pedestrian product mix, President's Day is
kind of the unsexiest of all the shopping holidays,
but also crucial for malls and stores.
This is sort of the anti-online shopping holiday. You actually have to lay on a mattress and try it out. You want to see how the appliances work. You have to test drive the car. So people are going to be going into stores again.
Where, she says, faced with physical temptation and human sales pitches,
they tend to make more impulse purchases, and the longer they're in a shopping environment, the more money they're likely to spend.
Still, Patty Edwards says even if consumers come in to touch and feel the merchandise, they're increasingly likely to compare prices and actually buy online, which is eating away at sales at brick-and-mortar stores.
They're having to get special merchandise in, do something that creates a draw, because just the date on the calendar isn't enough.
In most places, parking is free for the holiday. That's at least something. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
When you hear the words chow hall, you probably do not think, that is somewhere I would like to eat. Well, the military is hoping to change that. The Army is trying to improve the way it feeds its soldiers and get them to eat their broccoli, too. WUNC's Jay Price went to Fort Bragg and embedded in the lunch line.
Like so many things in the Army, chow halls go by an acronym. DFACs, short for dining facilities. By any name, they face a lot of challenges these days.
Fries, please.
Sergeant Michael Mueller got those fries and a sandwich and macaroni salad for lunch. He won't be back tonight for dinner, though.
Normally I go to off-post. It's the end of the day, so...
Maybe he'll head to one of the fast food places clustered around the base. Other soldiers in line say they'll grab pizza or a burger at one of the outlets that have sprung up on base, or they'll cook for themselves in the barracks. The Army, though, wants them to use the chow halls and is trying to convince them by using the carrot. Michael Williams is a senior civilian in Army logistics at the Pentagon.
We must, have a product that provides healthy and likable food choices, that provides better service and is the soldier's preferred choice.
That order from the brass talks about hiring food service consultants, developing new menus, and setting up kiosks and grab-and-go cases with extended hours, even food trucks.
We want to offer that soldier options when, he or she only has, a few minutes here, a few minutes there. They're moving from one, assignment or one task to another. Because what you don't want is that, you get off late at night and the only option you have is, maybe a fast food place.
Problem is, many soldiers are voting with their forks and their wallets. Chow hall meals are free for young troops living in the barracks, but lots are paying to eat somewhere else. Convincing them to do that less often would help with another Pentagon goal, getting soldiers to make a habit of healthy diets.
And that's where we teach and we educate.
You might have seen Colonel Sonia Cable in a photo with First Lady Michelle Obama a few years back. Cable is an Army dietitian who helped lead an initiative to improve chow hall nutrition and train soldiers to eat like athletes.
And maybe they're not going for that pizza every day, but maybe it's on the weekend, that's one meal out of all of them during the week.
Among other things, chow halls now put color-coded signs, red, yellow, and green, on the serving lines to show which foods are healthier. The Army is competing against fast food chains that include some of the world's savviest marketers. But Cable says it has the brain power and leadership to lure more soldiers back.
Even if we have to kind of shrink things, you give people the tools, in this case, the Army cooks, the equipment, the ingredients, the opportunity to explore recipes, get their creative juices going, and they come up with some great stuff. I see it here all the time.
If the Army needs a model for that, it doesn't have to look any further than another chow hall at Fort Bragg, the one run by 2nd Brigade, home of the special raspberry vinaigrette, Mongolian grill, sushi bar, and hand-tossed salads to order.
I did an Italian kebab last time. It was
That's specialist Megan Gonzalez, a cook, except here they call them chefs. This chow hall does some of the same things as successful civilian restaurants. The staff creates signature dishes that generate word of mouth, whips up specials for events, and tries to make diners feel like wanted guests.
We're trying to change the way that everyone perceives DFACs. We want them to see us as a restaurant and not just a chow hall. We want them to see us as an actual restaurant, and we want to offer them the absolute best.
And that's what the Army wants now, the best, from fewer chow halls. Oh, and hold the fries. At Fort Bragg, North Carolina, this is Jay Price for Marketplace.
We have a photo of one of those chow hall meals, plus a menu. You should check it out and decide if it looks tasty to you. Go to marketplace.org and click the mentioned on-air link in the upper left. Coming up.
And it really just allows the stylist to stay creative and just focus on their craft.
The app for that. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets were closed for President's Day, or on Wall Street, Washington's birthday. That's the official name of the holiday in the state of New York. Over in Europe, stocks rallied. Germany's DAX rose 2.67%. Britain's FTSE increased 2%. And France's CAC 40 gained 3%. Bargain-hunting investors snapped up shares in sectors that have taken a beating recently, such as banks. Societe Generale surged 4.3%. HSBC was up 1.3% after announcing yesterday that it will keep its headquarters in London and not move them to Hong Kong. Dutch finance group ING blossomed 5.7%. A further market boost came from comments by European Central Bank President Mario Draghi. He said the ECB might offer further stimulus measures if recent market volatility or low oil prices made that, you know, necessary. Here in the U.S., bond markets were closed, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. And now for a little more music news. We all know pop stars can make or lose fortunes, maybe enrich a few music execs. But if they're a really big deal, they actually create their own tourism industry. Take the Beatles. A new study by the Institute for Cultural Capital suggests that the Beatles are worth $115 million to the northern English city of Liverpool. And there are plans for all kinds of Beatles, let's call them heritage projects. The BBC's Stephanie Power reports.
So I'm in Strawberry Field. This is normally closed to the public, but the Salvation Army has let me in. I'm just standing a few yards away from the famous red gates. These are replica gates, but this is where lots of tourists come and stand on the other side, on the roadside, looking in and taking pictures.
Strawberry Field.
The site is owned by the Salvation Army, and there used to be a children's home here. Major Drew McComb, Divisional Commander of the North West, is showing me round.
Strawberry fields forever.
We can see the kind of famous red gate. The story is that John Lennon used to play in here, be brought here by his auntie.
That's correct. We're looking to develop the site into a work experience training centre for young people with learning disabilities. Around that, we're planning to build a cafe, also a heritage element to do with both the Salvation Army's history on site and also the Beatles' history on site.
It's not just us two here. Simeon Yates is here. You're the lead author of this new report. What do you think that the Salvation Army should be doing on this spot?
There's a huge infrastructure in Liverpool that supports the Beatles industry. 2,300 jobs, £82 million worth of stuff, but there's an awful lot of infrastructure that could be developed further.
One of the things I think is quite interesting is there's a lot of myths around what the individual Beatles might have done, where they might have gone. I know there's a lot of stories about Strawberry Field.
It's an issue that many of the stakeholders raise, is ensuring that the people who come and experience the Beatles in Liverpool get what they call an authentic, deep, meaningful experience here in Liverpool.
Where better to discuss authenticity than the place where the Beatles got together?
We're in St Peter's Church Hall, where John Lennon and Paul McCartney, well, officially had a conversation, and where Paul auditioned to join the Beatles. So we can say that this is where the Beatles really began.
Donna Jackson is a member of this church and a senior lecturer in modern history at Chester University.
What's happening in the hall here today is what happened when John was, you know, a member of the church and sang in the choir and so belonged to the youth clubs.
If there are lots of organisations and lots of people who make a bit of money out of this story, do you worry that sometimes a tourist might get the wrong story?
We get a lot of tour guides, taxi drivers around here, most of which are fabulous, some of which make me tear my hair out because they talk utter rubbish. There needs to be regulation and qualifications for anybody taking money from tourists and visitors and pilgrims to this city. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, journey for them to come and walk in the Beatles' footsteps.
I think a no, I mean a yes, but it's all wrong. That is, I think I disagree.
The Beatles' economy is worth a lot round here, but does capitalising on this heritage mean that Liverpool risks becoming a theme park? Back at Strawberry Field, Major Drew considers his plans.
We would want it not to be a theme park. I think going back to what Simeon was saying earlier about being something that's authentic, some of the key messaging out of the Beatles songs, for instance, would be something that we would want to align with love and peace and justice.
Strawberry fields forever.
That was the BBC's Stephanie Power. Smartphones and on-demand apps are changing the way people work across this country. They've created this so-called gig economy. But what if your job is already part of the gig economy and was well before smartphones? Well, then, goes the thinking, these new apps give independent practitioners more flexibility and control and easier ways to find clients. One example, Glam App. It lets you book an in-home hairstylist, a makeup artist, or a manicurist, sometimes within the hour. The year-old app is the brainchild of Cara Santana, an actress, and Joey Maloof, a hair and makeup stylist. It's operating in 20 cities across the U.S. Cara and Joey are here now. Thanks for joining us.
Hi.
We're already in unison.
This is what happens when you own a business together for a year.
I was going to say, clearly you have a great working relationship.
We do. We're also great friends, so I think the two really feed well off of one another.
All right. Well, so let's start with the founding, in fact. Cara, you guys don't have tech backgrounds. How did you decide to launch an app?
It's actually
You're
scary.
You're laughing at how much of a tech background you don't have.
Yeah, no, because it's actually really frightening to think that two people who have absolutely no business or tech experience started a tech company. But we did. I'm an actress. That's my background. And I wanted to create something that gave the everyday woman the feel of luxury Hollywood glamour, and I called Joey, and I really wanted to legitimize the business by having someone who really understood the plight of the freelance hair, makeup, and nail artist. And I brought him in, and I think he was a bit reluctant at first, but then after he sat on the idea, we decided that we could really create something that was equally advantageous for both consumer and provider and allow everyday women to have the ability for on-demand, affordable luxury beauty.
Right. And so what does I know that scheduling can be a really hard thing for an independent contractor and a freelancer. What do the stylists get out of this in terms of finding clients or avoiding working for a salon or cutting out the middleman?
Well, when Cara approached me with the idea, I took myself back to beauty school and I thought to myself, what would I want from an app like this? And the newer age of stylists, like, you know, kind of just want to work for themselves and, like, kind of work on a freelance basis.
And unlike salons, we take 10% commission from our stylists. They're, in essence, keeping 90% as opposed to a salon, which takes 40 to 60% because they have to pay the cost of overhead. And we don't have to do that because you're getting your service done in the quality of your client's home.
What's the potential downside, do you think, for a stylist being on that gig economy? Is it stressful for them to have to be available, you know, within 30 minutes to an hour?
Honestly, it's way less stressful because things like this didn't exist when I was a stylist, and being a freelance stylist is hard. I kind of just, you know, the struggle was real and I just went with it. But to find a hair and makeup agent or an agent of any kind, you know, it's really difficult. And, you know, they're taking 20% charging the client another 20%. So that's 40% out of the money that you're making. And by the time you got there, you're starving and you have bills to pay and, you know, credit cards that you've charged. So I just really think that it makes their life so much easier and so much less stressful.
What's your competition?
Well, we don't really see any of the other apps as competition necessarily. Like I said, they're all, I guess, similar in style, but what we do is very unique.
So then is your primary competition still the salon?
I wouldn't say that either because I think, I mean, you laugh, but I mean, I'm not trying
to. Because you're fixing it.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be cute and kitschy, but it's just like people who are going to go get their hair cut and colored are always going to go to a salon.
For sure.
People who are going to get their hair styled and people who are going to get their makeup done at home and people who are going to get a polish change at home, they don't want to go to the salon. So I don't see the salon as competition either. I feel like we've carved out a niche and, you know, we're driving our own force and we're sort of pioneers in that way.
And it really just allows the stylist to stay creative and just focus on their craft.
That's Cara Santana and Joey Maloof, founders and friends behind the glam app. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Earlier in the show, we talked about Tidal and Kanye West, but even assuming that Kanye's star power can help keep Tidal afloat, it sounds like he might be having some problems staying afloat himself. As he is prone to do, Kanye went on a Twitter tear this weekend. He said that he is $53 million in personal debt. Kanye said he's spent all his money on his fashion label, and he asked Mark Zuckerberg for $1 billion to fund his art and his ideas. He tweeted that he's in a place that many artists end up, and that even though he's personally rich and he can buy furs and houses for his family, he, quote, needs access to more money to bring more beautiful ideas to the world. Kanye also tweeted that offering money to him would be a better thing to do than building a school in Africa. You know, even if Kanye can't keep Tidal going, you got to think that Twitter should start paying him to just keep on doing Kanye. Ooh, maybe he could do like a theme park. Like a Beatles thing. All right, you don't have to be in your car to listen to Marketplace. All of our shows are available as podcasts on iTunes or wherever you like to podcast. So subscribe and you can listen to us anywhere. Also, I just discovered that you can tell your Amazon Echo to play Marketplace on TuneIn, and it works. The future is now. That's all we've got, and we gotta go. Markets were closed for President's Day. They will reopen tomorrow. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I am Molly Wood. Kai Rizdahl is back again tomorrow. Have a good night, everyone. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.